annual gathering of traditional West of Ireland boats in Kavara, called Cruinne Mhód, marked its 40th anniversary this year. It's the traditional end of summer regatta that forms a picture postcard view of Connemara and the West Coast. It's beloved by visitors and locals alike, and Lorna Siggins went along recently for Seascapes.
Kevin Carlin. All right. Kehud Tom.
30 seconds,
Copper. Not you in the back, come on.
All right.
Come on. Yeah, do all the regattas.
Okay, and how long have you been sailing?
Since I was tiny.
Right. And you're sailing the Glowchokes?
Glowchoke and the Baltimore.
Okay. What's the name of the Glowchoke?
Glowchoke. We have one at home, Lady Chantal, and then we have the one we won today, Niamh Maria.
Right. Okay.
And now we're sailing in the Capel. It's nice. It's different than the others. It's tradition. And
you're shouting.
It's like this very loud.
Do you think you'll be skippering someday yourself?
Hopefully.
Yeah. That was Chantal Flaherty, one of the youngest crew on one of the oldest vessels in the Connemara hooker fleet competing in the recent Cruinne Mhód in Kinvara. Her father, Dara, was skippering the vessel, owned by Pádraig Bailey, son of Johnny Bailey, who died in 2004. And this is the seventh generation of the family sailing a boat that was built in the 1860s in Lithermore.
Mickey Joe, Pádraig and Chantal.
And
Colleen Kelly's on the way.
And this is Johnny Bailey's boat?
This is Johnny Bailey's boat, Garriston, yeah.
Right off, Jimmy, you have to.
Alright, so much kill all time on Marshall that I'm going to take near, lads. Check with him for the chuggers. Mark that to the white and the gun.
It all kicked off in 1979, first organised by a friend of mine, Tony Moylan. We were all in there helping him. The people in Connemara thought he was totally mad to be trying to bring back these boats that were already gone since the 60s. But Tony persisted, and in Connemara they called him far more Nakheel Abioga, the big man with little sense. But Tony had more sense than they thought, and he, in fact, in the end, persuaded them to get their boats up and going again. Johnny Jimmy with the Madhum Warda, Johnny Bailey with the Capel, and the Tony with the O'Briens. He persuaded them to bring them back to Kinvara one more time. These boats that had been trading to Kinvara for about 200 years, and this is the 40th anniversary. They brought turf 40 years ago, and these boats are still bringing turf today, 40 years later, in the same boats, with the same families, six or seven generations later. And it's a wonderful thing that the heritage has been preserved. We've the Whale and Dolphin boat. We have Cún Beo, the organisation that's set up to preserve the bay and connect the water and the land. Mostly oyster fishermen and shellfish fishermen. So we've a lot of stuff. And there's cooking, there's lectures, talks going on about sea events. And later on today, we'll have the hooker and lavwad races. The Glowchog races had to be cancelled yesterday because it actually blew a gale here. And we had the heaviest rain we've seen for a long time. And it's quite funny because 40 years ago, when the three big hookers came in with turf and their calico sails, it rained exactly the same vertical rain 40 years ago at the same time. And it was a washout yesterday, but everybody came up to me afterwards and said they had a great time.
That was the voice of Dr. Michael Brogan, key organiser of the Cruinne, who's really delighted with the work of sculptor John Coll. He has made a plaque in memory of Tony Moylan, the founder of the Cruinne, and also the Kinvara Men's Shed Group has made a beautiful bench. And Clairman Michael Organ explained to me why he has been coming for the last 30 of the 40 years of the Cruinne.
Kinvara was lucky, God built it beside the sea, and the Connemara people apparently came in here years ago with turf. because, as you know, this area is limestoney and it's all stone and rock, and those of us that came from the country would be familiar with turf, but not around here. So they had to buy the turf, and that was the origin of it, coming in by boats. And the late Tony Moylan, who started the very first one in 1979, wanted to revive the tradition of boats coming into Kinvara with turf, and that's the history of the Cruinniú. And here we are today, and the boats are probably a little bit more sophisticated than the ones that came in here 15, 60 years ago with turf. You know, and now people switch on a switch for oil. They don't need... Some of the young people wouldn't even know what turf was.
I'm Fergal Langley. I farm oysters in South Galway Bay, in Muckinish Bay. And I buy seed from Carton Point Shellfish in Newquay there. It's a hatchery at about 3 to 4 mil in size. It takes about approximately about two and a half years to get up to... the size that we want, which is grade 3, which is about 65 to 80 gram.
Yeah, so I'm Dermot Kelly. I'm the chair of Cún Beo. So we're a community organisation set up 3 years ago now to, I suppose, give a voice to Galway Bay and to express an interest in the quality of the water and the marine environment and try and highlight the importance of that to the community, not just the people living alongside it, but the wider community in, up into the catchment, and also to highlight the importance of the connections between the people up in the catchment and down into the bay itself. And it's very easy to turn people off if you start giving out all the time. So to show the advantages and to show the benefits and all that, and to get the message out that way.
Community group Plastic Free Kinvara unfurled a flag and unveiled three billboards in the village on the eve of the Cruinniú. Co-chair Anna Murphy explained to me what it was all about and introduced me to several young earth keepers, including Cian Salmon and Sophie O'Grady.
So last Friday we had the launch of the community centre. We had, with the support of the community council, we hung this flag. And then we unveiled three billboards that we had earlier in the year, had a workshop with the Kinvara Youth Council, who were also wanted to become involved in the plastic campaigning and wanted to use it as their theme for the year. So they made three billboards, which we unveiled, hung on different pubs. Different owners allowed us to hang them, and we unveiled them on Friday. So it was a great event. Yeah.
And you worked, they worked with an artist.
They worked with Shona McGillivray, who works with teenagers and does a lot of outdoor mural type work. And we had seen some of her work in Gort, where she's based, so we asked her, would she lead the workshop with the teenagers? Yes. So, and it was just a one-day workshop with fantastic results.
My name is Cian Salmon, and an earth keeper is somebody who looks after the earth.
Hey, hello, my name is Hilda O'Grady. I'm a member of the Tidy Towns. I'm a volunteer for the last year, and we've been delighted this year to collaborate with Kinvara Plastic Free. Tidy Towns, people, a lot of people think it's all about flower pots, but there's a main, one of the main items on the framework is sustainability, and together we came up with the concept of the Earth Keepers Challenge. And really was a way of reinforcing behaviour that's been promoted at school with their families in a fun way. So getting out, doing beach cleans, doing litter picks, trying to use, you know, buy refillable cups instead of plastic bottles, having discussions about when you're shopping. So the challenge was all about promoting that this summer, and it's accumulating with a party today. They'll be doing some recycling games, and they'll be getting their certificates, and there's going to be prizes for the competition winners.
Vamos lá, vamos lá, vamos lá. kill all time on my shoulder, I mean, with your knee, lad. To put him for the chalkers, back to the white and the garnish.
Lorna Siggins at Cruinne Mhód. Now, recently, we were in Rathlin Island, where we heard some of the conservation ideas going on there. But also, the population of the island is on the rise and there's full employment there. There's a new ferry service, many yachts that go up the Irish Sea dock at its marina. And back in 2016, the Islanders voted overwhelmingly in favour of remaining in the EU. Our reporter Mike McCartney has been to the island, where he first spoke to Marina McMullen, who's secretary of the Rathlin Development and Community Association. She says Brexit is a major worry for people there.
This year we don't have as many European visitors as we would have, and I think that may affect it. And also with Brexit, we've got European money for our harbours and for our electricity, etc. And I don't know what's going to happen now, especially where we live in an isolated community. And I think it will have an impact, certainly. I think at the minute it's going to happen. It's just a mess. It is. It really and truly is a mess. So hopefully something will be resolved, but it's difficult to know.
The last time I was here, there was less housing than there is in the island now. So is that a situation? Are there people waiting for housing, or are we going in the right direction?
We are going in the right direction. Rathlin's population has increased. We have a population at the present moment time of 150. Rathlin's population at one time was down at 75, and it's gone up to 150. We have 12 at primary school, and we have another 7 or 8 at secondary school, and we have another maybe 8 as well to start school. So certainly our population has increased. Also, we have full employment on Rathlin, so that's good. We have a new car ferry in the last 2 years. That takes 140 passengers, and that's work for 5 crew. Week on, week off. And we also have a 20-minute boat, the Rathlin Express, and there's another 3 or 4 work on that. So with this result, you've got 14 full-time jobs there. So that's 14 families can live in Rathlin 24/7.
Like every other tourist area, the tourist season in Ireland as a whole can be short enough. I suppose you would like a replacement industry to help during the lean months of the year, or do you?
Yes, you would. And you're always trying to, people are always trying to see if they can create employment. You maybe have part-time jobs, you know, quite a number of part-time jobs. Say with your manor house, your public house, anybody in the tourist industry, bed and breakfast. We have new hostels, new glamping pods next door to us here. That all creates employment, but as you say, that's just seasonal. Whereas the ferry service is 24/7, and you would like to increase it to at least 8 months of the year. And it would help to keep people, keep young families. We would like to see more young families come and live on the island.
Talk to me about the visiting yachts.
Well, you're visiting yachts, that's a big part of our economy. You have come from Wales, the south of England. They come up the Irish Sea and come into Rathlin because the tide suits, and then they're heading up for the Scottish coast, and they're spending maybe the summer up there, and then they're coming back down again. And Rathlin has got a safe harbour now, which we can keep capacity for about 40 yachts. And that's a large part of our economy. A lot of new yachts coming in now from maybe Germany, France. We've got ones from Australia there and New Zealand. And it's a big part of our economy.
For fisherman Benjie McFall, the industry has been very good to him in recent times. But with Brexit on the horizon, there is uncertainty as to where his future lies.
Well, we run an 11.5 metre crab and lobster boat. That's what we do. Like, so we fish mainly for shellfish. It's all crab and lobster along the north coast and out the back of the island and around the island as well. So we fish all year round, weather permitting. I mean, we're tied up with bad weather in the winter, but we get out when we can get out, you know. Employing two fellas from the island, like, there's three of us all together in the boat, like, you know. That's sort of what we do, like, you know, and that's what I've been doing for a long time.
And how has the fishing industry been for you in the last few years?
Well, it's been sort of, the crab market actually had a wee increase over the last year, so it has. It seems to have sort of fell back a bit now, but I think that was sort of to do with the Chinese market that was broken into, that they managed to get some of the shellfish out of China, which sort of increased the price, and then it put the French and the Spanish had to compete to buy the crab as well, so it sort of helped things, but as I say, it sort of came back a wee bit. But all in all, you know, I mean, we just have the same problems as everybody else. Fuel prices, you know, blah de blah, it's all the same sort of stuff, like, you know.
And Brexit?
I'm worried about what's going to happen, but the problem is I don't really know what is going to happen, if you get me, like, you know. I mean, the danger would be that if we left the EU, that it would cost more to put the shellfish across to the continent, which would have that cost would be passed on, and would be the man at the bottom of the ladder would probably feel the worst of it, like, which would be the fisherman, like. So that would be our main issue, like, you know. And then obviously being in the north end of this country here with a border, it would put our stuff would be less likely to be sourced or bought by French and Spanish buyers when they can buy it in the Eurozone, which would be in the Republic. So we'd be sort of disenfranchised and that way, like, you know, if they went the worst way, you know, that's definitely a worry. And then also, like, you know, a lot of the rope that we would buy, the crab rope, you know, that's manufactured in Portugal, you know, and a lot of the fishing gear, components of the fishing gear is manufactured in Europe, so then that has to come in. So then that's obviously going to cost more if there's tariffs for that to come in and take longer periods of time for it to come in. That's a danger there. So you could also end up getting, like, a lot of companies that will start outsourcing stuff in China, which is fair enough, but, you know, generally the quality tends not to be as good, you know, so it doesn't. So that's another one.
Down at the Manor House, Sarah Coyle and Rosian Foster have noticed a change in the nationalities coming to the island. Rosian says that there are not as many Europeans visiting the hotel this year.
I think Brexit has affected it. It's not as busy as it was the past 20 years. There is still a different amount of people coming in from abroad and stuff, but it's mainly Northern Irish people or Southern people that's coming this year.
Is there a worry on the island about Brexit as far as tourism is concerned?
It might be non-verbal, but I think after the last couple of months, you can definitely feel a change. People will probably be more vocal about it. You know, it was one of those things they're afraid to talk about because nobody really knows the knock-on effect yet. It's hard to tell whether it's the weather or Brexit, but something's definitely happened. It's a noticeable change from last year. Last year was so successful.
And for people that come to the island and you've heard them speak amongst themselves, what are they looking for when they come over here?
People just want to relax and get away with their kids and their dogs. So it's not high expectations. You just want to have a good time and switch off.
Roisin, would you notice that there's a very close community on the island that works together?
Yeah, like everybody's always willing to help you and they're there if you need them. Very close.
You're from Cookstown, so what drew you to the island? What did you notice about the island when you arrived here?
I just love it. As soon as I got here, I seen how everybody is so nice, and like I got really close to everybody so quick. And if I go back to the mainland, I just want to come back here, and just this feels like home, and has for most people.
Talk to me about the ferry service to and from the island, because I believe that the company here is involved.
Yeah, the ferry company runs all year round, obviously, and then the sailings become less regular in the wintertime. Just they're a hardworking bunch of people. Yeah, especially the summer, because it's full on. It's a long shift. It's like early morning to evening.
What would you like to see happening more in the wintertime when all the tourists have gone?
Nobody likes to say that when the tourists go that you're, you know, you breathe a sigh of relief. It's more, you do work very hard, and it's nice to have the contrast, but I think people would like the season to maybe be lengthened and business to be viable for a longer part of the year, because it's a short season. Yeah, it's hard to make a good business here.
Is there room for another industry on the island?
Always. I think that, you know, the sky's the limit, and there's so much potential. I know they're talking about the East Lighthouse venture, and yeah, I think where there's imagination, it's, you can do anything really.
In your case, you're a chef, so the fish is really fresh because you go out and catch the mackerel. Tell me about it.
Yeah, sometimes I, when I have an evening off, I go out with my friends on the boat and we get the mackerel and I take it back and prep it, and then we use it as a special in the restaurant here.
So it's time to bid farewell to Rathlin Island. David Quinney Mead, the Rathlin Community Development Worker, joins us on the ferry back to Ballycastle. He spoke of the cloud of uncertainty that lies over the island.
Brexit is certainly a big issue, and I think, as it is for most people in Northern Ireland, it's the uncertainty of just not knowing what's going to happen. And the fears that tariffs will have a big impact on the farmers. As you probably heard, if you've spoken to the fishing family on the island there, they're already concerned about price increases and buying their goods from across the border and then trading across the border and trading into Europe. Very, very complex to try and unpick all of that and wonder what's going to happen next. And the impact on the island, if any one of those families feels the economic pinch too much and then has to relocate off the island, you're pushed up against a small community that's going to start leaking. And I mean, you know what it's like living on an island. You've got to keep your foot on the pedal to keep going forward, and if you take it off, it starts to go down again.
EU funding, that's going to be no more if there is Brexit, and it's going down the track fast.
Is that true? I thought you were going to give us money anyway. Well, again, that's the uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen. The island has survived on a lot of EU funding in the past, as has a lot of the area around here. And if we lose that, yeah, we don't know where it's going to go. I mean, obviously, EU funding to farmers is going to... We're presuming Brexit goes ahead. Let's try not to. But if it does go ahead, then we'll lose that. And the government will have to replace it in some way. And, of course, they promise that they will. But, I mean, as we've seen in the last couple of years, the Westminster government doesn't really seem to understand what's going on in Northern Ireland anyway. So it's very difficult to believe that Westminster will supply the needs of Northern Ireland if all of that goes.
Mike McCartney with that report from Rathlin Island. Now, a sea rescue reminiscent of the movie The Poseidon Adventure has been ongoing off the coast of the US in recent days. The 650-foot Korean car transporter, the Golden Ray, capsized shortly after leaving harbour in Georgia. There were 24 people on board, 20 were quickly rescued, but 4 were trapped underwater in the capsized ship. Rescues reached them by drilling through the hull. One of them, Sean Colgan, told how he first discovered the missing crew members were alive.
It is a very emotional moment. It's there's a visual disconnect because you're communicating through a series of tapping. And so you're only hoping that, you know, whoever's in there is actually physically hitting something hard, letting us know that they're well-bodied, they're able-bodied, or they may be ambulatory, and they can help get themselves out once we gain access. But when we got the first half-inch hole to get an air monitor in, it's pretty incredible. You know, and to be honest, I would think those guys that were in that ship are probably the strongest in terms of mental fortitude of anything I've seen. When we made a 4-inch hole to pass them water, lights, and communications, the first thing that they asked for, three of them were grouped together, the first thing that they asked for were a set of tools so that they could go make their way and try to assist in the rescue of the fourth person, because he was in a separate location. Nearby, they could hear each other, but they couldn't get to each other.
Coast Guard Captain John Reed took up the story before the fourth person was rescued.
But once we got the first 3-inch hole in today, they were able to be past water, and we were able to get them food and some fresh air. And that's probably the biggest. And whether they were together, no. The three were together in one spot. The fourth is stuck behind a glass enclosed in a engineering control room. With those same experts who got us to where we are right now, we're going to find a way to get him safely extracted from that room as well. We'll continue to press forward.
How big a hole was ultimately drilled to get these folks out?
About 2 feet by about 3 feet. And it was done in 3-inch increments. So it was like connect the dots.
Captain, how did it feel when you first discovered they were alive?
It was outstanding. When I heard the news this morning that we had tap backs throughout the night, I think that really motivated the team here from the Defiant Marine, who was leading some of the groups on board, as well as the team from Vertical Safety and Rescue. And knowing that the people were alive made all the difference. And knowing where to go on a ship that's 600 plus feet big, where to go was an outstanding job by the engineers last night and the salvage team putting that plan together. I know it's a lot hotter in that ship than it was for us on the outside, and I'm sure on the outside it was probably pushing 120 or more.
Like what their emotions were when they got out, was there anything that they said?
I think they were pretty relieved. I don't have information on what they said. I know they looked super happy to be outside of that space and coming down onto the tugboat and then further moving in here. Yes, sir.
Can you just talk about sort of the process that went from one narrowing down where they were on the ship and then actually having their communication and then finding them, please?
I can give you a little bit about that. And we were out there yesterday and did some of that tapping in the morning, which was a little disheartening because you kept hearing things fall in the ship and you weren't sure if those were people or if they were cars. But there was just a system of tapping where they would do three or four. The chief engineer from the ship was actually out there translating. So he was able to communicate in Korean with the three members who were in that one space.
How at risk is he?
he's probably the greatest risk of all four right now. And to tell you the truth, we don't know, because we don't have the monitoring in his space that will provide that.
How far is he from the location where you got the three others?
I don't have that exactly. I believe it was one deck, but when you're talking decks now, the whole thing is turned on its side. But we know they have seen him.
Yeah, so after you rescue the crew members, how did you extract that vessel?
Yes, ma'am. So as the captain mentioned, we have some concurrent operations going on. Obviously, the priority at this point is still the rescue operation, but we're also still moving forward with salvage plans and pollution mitigation response.
And that was the U.S. Coast Guard, and everybody was safely rescued eventually from the Golden Ray.